Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 5 on the giving of orders by Mary Parker Follett. For more information and to get a version of the text, please go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that conversation. Now, back to the discussion.
So one of my observations was that she talks about the authority of the situation and decisions and orders should flow from that. And she does make a concession on page 34 about the situation, you know, can be seen differently and often interpreted differently, but she doesn't go a whole lot further into what those different interpretations are. So I was wondering, Dimitri, what your perspective on that is.
Well, I mean, this goes back to what we discussed about, I guess what I'm mainly clinging onto is, what do you do with this whole situation concept? And she concedes the point that people do experience situations differently. So if you and I, we may be doing the same thing, but we may find ourselves in different situations. You know, that's what I perceive to be a situation, you may perceive to be a non-situation or a different situation or so on and so forth. So I think key here is for her is how do you make sure or how do you facilitate the similarity between perceptions of situations? Well, one thing is what we talked about, this whole Marxist legacy of you can physically facilitate similarity of how people interpret the world and what they do by manipulating or alternating their material conditions. So equipment, surroundings, even clothing, you know, can be on an aircraft carrier deck springs to mind, also to relate to Ralph's points in part one, where different tasks are literally color-coded on different individuals. But also in factories, you have different color jumpsuits and things like that. So you have this very primary perceptive way of dividing work and labor. Or alternatively, there's, of course, training that Miranda mentioned earlier on, that Follett hinted at this idea that supervisors or foreman managers, whatever, the supervisory staff, they ought to be undergoing some form of immersive training together with the employees. And by doing that, I think the idea is that this would facilitate people interpreting, it's not even the situation yet, people interpreting different stimuli in a way that would construct a situation that they could all relate to and thus eliminate the need for direct commands.
Right, and I think it's that she recognizes that the situation is constructed. She actually has a great, she gets to some of what you're talking about kind of indirectly, though, when on page 35, where she talks about preparing the attitude for integration. I think that's what you're talking about, Dimitri, where this kind of joint training thing.
Maybe. I'm not sure if she does, though, recognize that situations are constructed. Maybe I forgot from the reading.
Oh, no, she does. She says on page 34, a situation will often be seen differently and interpreted differently. So to me, that's an acknowledgement that they're constructed differently.
Right. Well, to me, that means that there is a situation, which is something real, objective, absolute, you know, however you may wish to term that.
Yeah,
and then
be.
You have actors coming into the situation and building or assuming relations that are a result of that situation. Because throughout the reading, she talks a lot about the situation of this, the situation of that, the authority of the situation. I think for her, situation is something like a fundamental building block of the social, of the organization.
Yeah, all I can say is it may be ambiguous, right? I mean, so you may be right that that's the way she sees it, but there's also room for concluding that whatever that situation is, it can be interpreted differently. And therefore, it's that interpretation and that process of integrating those interpretations that's important. So I think you could go either way on that.
I agree. I don't think the question of whether individuals are coming into the situation and identifying it correctly or building it themselves does that much difference to this particular text. Mm-hmm. Because the outcome and the input of this is, of course, that you need to have some kind of a touch base that you can use to arrive to the same understanding of what's going on.
Yes.
I want to reflect a bit on this whole thing of the situation, because when you first brought it up in the first section, Dimitris, I didn't really see your point, but now I see. And I think one of the problems is that she doesn't give a lot of examples in the text. But if we go the direction you were going, which I think is very interesting, using our knowledge of organizational theory, we can think of many ways in which, to use Ralph's term, the situation is constructed. You know, you are referring to this Marxist idea of the tools that you give people and basic things as they were dressed and so on and so forth, in ways that you construct that environment. We know from organizational theory that the way you design your organization, the chain of command, who responds to what, where these people physically base in the organization, are all elements that we know from theory that are a way to structure how work takes place in organizations. So I think those could be the tools.
Right. So basically all the things that we mentioned just now with Ralph, both the surroundings and the socialization of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. That sounds like the entire organization. You know, you have the building and the employees, for instance, in a very basic sense.
And I think you have a point there that's an interesting one, because a lot of modern management theory and practice is about trying to get employees or the workers or team members or whatever language you want to use to identify personally with the mission of the organization or what it's trying to accomplish. That many organizations feel like they get more creativity, more commitment, maybe in Follett's terms, recognition of what the situation demands by trying to get those aligned as closely as possible. Because a lot of organizations talk today and also in management theory about fit, you know, getting a good fit with the employee. Whereas back in Follett's time, that was, you know, you just do the work, you show up, you take these orders, you know, sort of this command and control stuff. So I think that's another way to look at it.
I got a hint of that on page 33 in the third sentence where she says, one person should not give orders to another person, but both should agree on their orders from the situation. I underlined that and wrote unity of strategy there.
Yeah.
And this rings a bell to our episode 2 on Fail.
Yes.
Where he had this managerial unitarism where everyone goes in the same direction. So you suspect that something similar is going on here then?
Yes.
But I think she is hitting on something. It's the same direction, but in a different gear. Because she's talking about the more psychological things. So it's more about, as we were saying before, the training, the socialization, things that we know today, as Ralph was saying, is producing the right kind of individual for that kind of task, which is something that, you know, has been widely debated in management and organizational theory in light of cultural control, normative control. There is the work of Kunda about engineers in that famous tech firm.
Yeah, the engineering culture, I think, is the name.
Yes.
Of the book, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk more about normative control, definitely.
Okay, well, one last thing about the culture and perspectives. I think Follett's also talking about unicultural organizations from the perspective that it's in one society, and you get a whole different challenge in organizations or situations where people from different cultural perspectives, right? Because then the sort of that understanding of the situation is culturally as well as socially influenced.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's a weakness of Follett per se, because I think that really is the situational view of the taking the orders or understanding from the situation is a means to an end for her to say, well, you don't need as much hierarchy if you get people to focus more on the situation and what needs to be done. And then you kind of integrate their perspectives. I think one of us was saying earlier, I know it wasn't me, but one of you was saying earlier about sort of the systems view that Follett advocates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think integration is all about that. You know, look at these kind of different aspects of the system and then coming to a common understanding. That's important. Not necessarily that everybody have the same understanding, but you're trying to create a process to develop a better understanding, maybe.
The most interesting thing for me is that it's a very current discussion. In a way, she was already hitting at that.
But my question is, so beyond the idea of person fit, what do you think the unifying purpose is within this idea of giving orders? Like, what is the direction when we talk about direction, obedience? What is the goal? Is it the goal of the firm? Is it the goal of the individual? I think that's a bit blurry within the text.
I think it's closely related to overall goals of scientific management, because one way to think of this is that she repeatedly talks about depersonalizing orders, which can be interpreted as we have in part one, basically not hurting people's feelings by bossing them around.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could equally be interpreted as just removing personality, so people become their roles, which is very similar to Taylor.
Mm.
But do you think she has in mind the mission of the firm or of the organization? Or does she have in mind ideas of efficiency?
I think it's all of those things. I think it could be all of those things. I think she's deliberately ambiguous about that because it could be your work group and what its function is in the firm. It could be how it matches with what your life goals, ambitions, what, you know, social aspirations, you know, those kinds of things. I think it'd be all of those things.
Because I think it's a missed point in the sense that we do talk about internal conflict within the person. So there's this idea of not being bossed around, wanting to be independent, but there isn't really the idea or a specific definition of what is the unifying purpose.
Yeah, I'll just say to add that she talks about internal conflict, but doesn't talk about conflict exposed in relations.
Yeah, in the sense we do know that there is external or explicit conflict in the sense of conflict between different stakeholders, different goals, and that is quite a missed opportunity, I think, within the text.
I think it's because it's not really a text, it's a lecture.
Lecture.
And in the last sentence, she reveals that it is a lecture given
for
this conference, the Scientific Foundation of Business Administration, which, as we know from episodes 1 and 2, was almost exclusively concerned with efficiency. So in light of this drive to reduce waste in giving commands and orders, I think is primarily motivated by enhancing efficiency, but perhaps in a more responsible, as she puts it.
We should have been there and raised our hands.
Sorry, a question. But I was thinking, and something made me think of Taylor, not Taylor, Fayol, which is, in a word that we assume a unitarist perspective, you know, that the goal of the organization is the goal of the leader, which is the goal of the work, and everyone is going in line and everything's coherent, it's fine. He doesn't have to acknowledge. But once you start acknowledging that there is negotiation going on in organizations, things get tricky, you know, because you're not just following by the line, by the letter, but there is, you know, this participative, democratic, whatever, back and forth dimension, which doesn't assure that you're all going to the same direction at the end of the day.
Yeah, so I think she's focused on the collaboration more than the exact mission of the organization. I think she recognizes it's socially determined. She doesn't really say it. And so, Miranda, I think you have a good point that's sort of missed in the lectures that she gives. And it's possible that if she was writing a paper as opposed to giving a talk, she would have gone into more detail. And she has hints of that in various parts of the paper where I don't have the time to go into this or go into that. But I also found that less satisfying that it wasn't, you know, that she wasn't able to go into that. But since we're talking about people's priorities and whether there's unitary agreement on all that or these kind of diverse perspectives, she has a quote on page 36 that made me think of work experience. It says, it's right at the top of the page. It says, "People do not like to be ordered even to take a holiday." And of course, when I discovered that, I've actually seen that to be true in the work world. They told me that shipyards typically will have a shutdown over the holidays because what they find out is so many people take vacation, you can't be productive because there's too many people missing. And there's a lot of expertise that is necessary. So basically, shipyards will shut down for a week to 10 days. And I was talking to somebody in the finance department. They said that there are some people that actually take leave without pay during that period. And I said, "You got to be kidding me." I said, "The company is granting you, you know, this vacation period. You know, they're paying you. They would pay you for it. And people refuse to do that. They'll just not get paid." She says, "Yeah, they don't like the idea of being told they have to take vacation." And I thought, well, that's pretty amazing, actually. But, you know, I came to understand a little bit better. And here it's right there in print. Very interesting.
It is, yes. I mean, if you think of it, someone going and telling you to take a break, it's almost like you're being taken off a pitch in a game to go and, you know, sit one out, which isn't entirely flattering or possibly motivational.
Well, and usually the social context in which that occurs, if it's not a holiday period, like you said, Dimitri, it's take a break. It's more like you're getting pulled out as a pitcher, right? So it essentially just has this connotation that you're failing or not measuring up or you need a bit of a rest. And so oftentimes it's not, you know, it's all about delivery, of course, but it can be insulting, demoralizing, you know, whichever language, you know, people can take that in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I think an interesting thing is that after having read the text, it's kind of as if Follett had taken away my original definition of giving orders, of the order. Like, that does not exist anymore. There's this idea of being involved and the situation and figuring out the solution and collaborating. Mm-hmm. But the traditional idea of giving orders doesn't exist anymore at the end of the day. Because my idea of giving orders was strictly related to especially the way in which orders are given. So this idea of ordering, of being bossy, but not that extreme, but still with a certain level of authority.
Yeah, so it's interesting you would say that, because having spent 29 years in the Navy, I would usually take Follett's approach for going over orders or giving directions, and I would not usually say, Pedro, go do this. I would try to come to some kind of joint understanding, because of the nature of the kind of work that we were doing. Usually it was not, you know, how would you like to wear the right uniform today? Those things I was very prescriptive about. But when it came to something else, I would largely make suggestions, and I was criticized for that. I had peers that said, hey, you're too nice. You're always asking people what to do. And in your position, you should just tell them what to do. I had more than one person criticize me for that. And I thought, okay, but I get better agreement and understanding, and I give them room to interpret, you know, what to go do. So I think I get better results that was this way. But there are other people who looked at me as being an ineffective and weak leader, because I would largely convey the things I thought needed to be done in the form of suggestions, and made it clear to people, you could give me feedback, or you could give me, you know, another way to do it. And oftentimes when I gave people who weren't used to working with me that kind of latitude, they weren't quite sure what to do. When I said, you know, it's like, well, I'm trying to do what you told me. I said, well, actually, what I want to do is get as close as you can. And then, because sometimes they would say, well, I can't do what you want, so I'm done. I said, no, that's not quite what I had in mind. How close can you get? What can you do? And then you could see them puzzling over that and saying, oh, well, I could do this and I could do that. And it took them a while to get comfortable with that sense of freedom that I gave them.
Right. That's because you're breaking the law of the situation.
Yes.
The material conditions of the ranks and the uniform and the socialization into the line of command, those all go in opposition to what you said you were doing.
Yes.
And we have a similar example. I was teaching for a few years this module where we would give second year business students a very general brief to conduct a macroeconomic analysis, almost independently, with no particular milestones that they would need to hit on. And that was pretty much the entire mark that they would get. And wow, that was so stressful for them. All the uncertainty and the breaking of the law of the situation that would normally be the assignment, which is where you have a clear task and the criteria for evaluating this task, or rather the performance, that was all gone. It wasn't there. Every year they would stress out tremendously. And granted, once they would complete the task, they would report feelings of satisfaction as to their own achievements. But until then, there would be a lot of complaining and people were not happy at all, to say the least.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you point out that they experienced stress from that, because I saw the same thing. Even when I gave people that kind of flexibility, until they got to know me. So there was a socialization process. But initially, they would be very stressed over that, because I took away, because I wanted more creativity, more participation, I took away that sort of, well, you know, if you follow my order, you can blame me for it being wrong, right? And then when I made it clear that it was more participative for them, it was stressful initially, but I found people came to like it after a while. It's just, it took a socialization process.
This is very interesting, because what you're both describing is an organization that is built into hierarchy, both academia and the military, but you are given a case in which you, Ralph, in your work, and Dimitri in the lecture, you are giving people a different attitude. You are enlisting them a different behavior, which is exactly what she talks about, you know, a different behavior pattern from these people. And it's interesting that there is a lot of stress in changing that, in rebuilding, re-socializing, relearning. You know, that's something that we're just not very theorizing, not very discussing. The problem and the stress that comes with, you know, adapting to these different switching modes, almost.
Yeah, in fact, I saw that in our graduate program at George Washington, where we would get some of these kind of open-ended assignments, and the professors weren't very prescriptive about how to do it or what was expected. After the first one of those, what I figured out was that means you can do whatever you want, for the most part. So, of course, you're taking some risks, but I had classmates that were very stressed out. Well, they won't tell us what they want. They won't tell us what the requirements are. And I would say to them, yeah, and that means you get to construct it yourself. So you have much more flexibility in a situation like that. But like Dimitri was saying, they weren't comfortable having that kind of, you know, freedom or flexibility.
Yeah, well, I think the main thing was that even though the process was liberated from the hierarchy of what it was supposed to be, the appraisal of results would still be traditionally made, and the consequences of those results would still have the same implications as in more prescribed processes.
Ah, okay. So that's sort of a catch-22, as we would say in the United States.
Yeah. But, okay, so, you know, Pedro has a point that military and, to a lesser extent, academia are quite vertical, and that causes stress, structural stress, maybe even, to use a building analogy. But what about if we take a very fluent hippie organization
No, sorry, I was saying that when you have a vertical hierarchy organization and you try to lead in a more democratic way, the change causes stress. It's not necessarily, no, it is being hierarchical that creates stress.
I think we're talking about the same thing.
Okay.
Sounds like it.
Well, I'm just trying to
do the opposite.
The other spectrum.
Oh, I see. I see.
What happens then? Okay, we have an entrepreneur team of three friends who start a software company.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Quite a common example these days. Mm-hmm. And Google buys them or whatever.
Okay.
How does that change the law of the situation? Can it be said that there was a law of the situation beforehand? I mean, not to bring us back to discussing the mechanics of situation. I'm just curious about to what extent, as I think Miranda suggested, different types of work that they require different situations. So to what extent do certain types of work or regimes of work perhaps command the rigidity of the law of them? Does that make sense?
Okay, so I didn't think of the software case because, you know, it's an organization that is being born, so I think it's more tricky, but I know I thought about public services like municipal government and all kind of stuff. And you have the whole arrival of more managerial ideas, you know, new public management, all those things. I remember when I was part studying this council in London, you know, and they were changing things, adopting a more managerial way to handle the whole services. It creates a lot of stress as well, you know, because people had an idea what it was supposed to be public service, and then you bring this whole new government regime and there's a lot of ruffles around.
That's a good point. That reminded me of what's happening at the National Healthcare Service right now.
Mm-hmm.
I recently spoke to one of the senior people in the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry,
mm-hmm.
and he said this very interesting thing, that the whole system is based in this Protestant ethic, but not the one that Durkheim called the spirit of capitalism, but the opposite, that you're supposed to, or rather you're not supposed to turn profit off a public service. And that apparently causes quite a lot of structural friction during these new public management changes mm-hmm. and processes.
Yeah, so there you go. The opposite case.
Okay, where does that get us with Follett?
She's a bit, you know, too, I don't want to say naive, but she edits out the whole stress and challenge that goes into the whole creation of a new behavior pattern among employees. You know, the way she describes it seems very automatic and takes a lot of struggles and efforts and loose ends and all that kind of stuff. That gets that, which is missing in the text.
Yeah, I think she's overly simplified then.
I think there's one aspect that is overlooked in this oversimplification, which is the fact that she talks about situations in the common sense of the word, where there are specific roles, there is a hierarchy, there is someone that you know should be the one giving the orders,
mm-hmm.
and you already know who he or she should be giving the orders to. So mm-hmm. there are roles.
Okay.
She doesn't really talk about, even though I suppose it could fit in, something else, some other source of authority, which could be knowledge, which could be, I don't know, social dynamics or even past habits. Who is the one who usually makes the final call? Who is the one who knows the most about this?
Mm.
So I suppose to a certain extent that if you work on that level, you could adapt it to other forms of organizations.
I think you hit it right on the head here, actually. Mm-hmm. Because one way of thinking of giving orders is assuming responsibility. And if you
yes.
delegate orders to a larger group, then you obviously, as a result, delegate responsibility, which presumably no one really wants, especially if they're not comfortable with that, which is, I think, what's happening with at least my example of teaching that module.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can sort of offshore responsibility to something as disembodied as knowledge, say,
okay.
well, I, you know, this didn't work out, but we did everything according to the best practice, so, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's not our fault
mm-hmm.
type of situation, then maybe that is the alternative way that she is proposing, as Miranda said.
Yes, that's actually very interesting, because I think she briefly mentions resistance and how employees at times are allowed to go against and do what they perceive to be the right thing to do, given the situation, quote unquote. And I think that's exactly the point, because they are referring not to the direct authority over them, but I don't know, if they're like engineers doing, I don't know, product development, and they feel that's the standardized way to do things, or doctors that they prefer to abide to the clinical guidelines instead of the management of the hospital perceives to be the right way to treat something, you know. So I think that's the direction we could think of these things.
And if we take that in concert with the general scientific management direction of the whole thing that we discovered, then it appears to be very compatible with the rest of it. Taylor went about it a different way, but you would still, so you know, you take the one best way, for instance, and then instead of shoving it down people's throats, you give it more symbolic status of best practice. Nowadays is popular way of describing that, and that is then part at least of a situation. Would you agree?
I would, but then it comes my perhaps biggest critique of Follett, is that she assumes there is too much autonomy in employees to resist, to go against, to criticize, to even interact with the bosses. I think on page 37 she says, if an order goes against the craftsman or the clerk, think is the way of doing his work which will bring the best results, he is justified in not wishing to obey that order.
Yeah, I thought that was very simplistic. You know, she's just looking at this very narrowly, like you assume the craftsman or the clerk has all the requisite knowledge. They perceive the situation, you know, better because of detailed knowledge. So I can, yes, there's situations where you can imagine that being the case.
I just want to add, she finished the sentence say, could not that difficulty be met with a joint study of the situation? And she puts like a question mark. And the point is that we know, as you were saying, Rolf, not only there is a complexity aspect that we said, but also there is the overall authority in the way organizations are run. They are power arenas. You know, you obey, you have to do things.
Yeah, this sentence can actually be interpreted in different ways. If it's a tongue-in-cheek thing, then a joint study of this situation can also be read as taking the employee and showing them that they're wrong.
Yeah, perhaps you're right.
And also, you know, she says that he's justified in not wishing to obey that order, but she doesn't say that it's okay for him not to anyway.
Yeah, I guess she was emphasizing the not wishing part as opposed to justified in not obeying the order. Yeah, I took that probably a little more strongly than I should have, because that was causing me some problem at first.
I think it's further to Miranda's point that she didn't want to go as far for whatever reasons. And I think justified in many ways to say that lower level employees are just, you know, what Taylor said, they're very cognitively limited.
And I think you can also see when she's saying stuff like that, why managers in large organizations are going to be inclined to put that on a shelf when she's not actively speaking at it, because that makes, I just know that, sorry, I strongly feel like that's going to make managers uncomfortable. There's this whole idea like, well, I have to go explain things to employees and stuff, because a lot of what I have seen in organizations is managers will often take a path that's just cognitively simpler for them. Like, it's easier for me to just give this order, because it does take time and effort and some creativity to kind of break things down for people and explain, hey, here's why we're doing this, here's where you fit in. Deming talked about you should make it clear to every employee where he fits in the system, what his contribution is. But I've seen a lot of managers that aren't willing to take the time, and they'd rather just give orders.
I was about to say that I find a slightly bit naive, this assumption that there is so much time to do all these studies. There are definitely organizations, first of all, I don't know, health services, where time is of essence. You can't go there. I mean,
yeah.
Well, that's what we're for.
But I want to be a bit anti-devil's advocate and say that she starts the lecture saying that she's not to tell how to run your own organization, but what she expects for you to be reflective about it. So if you understand that this whole democratic, more participative thing doesn't fit, as long as you know and you abide for that, you know, because you're pressed for time, you're pressed for any other things, you can follow. But then you are given the possibility to reflect on that and say, well, there are situations when I can be more open-ended, in which I can be more willing to engage with the employee.
Oh, yes, certainly. She mentions repeatedly the unnecessary and unwarranted verbal abuse of the foreman, the employees, that rather disapprovingly, I gather, that you don't have to shout at them the orders. There's other ways that are far more humane and conducive to cooperation and maybe even some forms of innovation. She says in the very end, okay, one principle can surely guide us here. Don't blame for the sake of blaming. Make what you have to say accomplish something. say it in that form at that time under those circumstances, which will make it a real education to your subordinate. That's on page 42.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's talking about education. There's an adult learning aspect of this that I thought was very attractive.
Yes.
Also, give constructive feedback. That was one of the first ideas I thought of.
Which is, if you reflect, very traditional HRM practice today. Mentoring, feedback, all these kind of things that are very, you know, common sense today in the way managers lead. What's expected from them, at least. No, I think that she was actually hinting at something that was not so common practice back then, in which there was a much more mechanic way of leading, and all these, you know, more constructive, nurturing ideas are, in a way, very common. Not every day, not every time, but, you know, overall, through the work that someone does.
Oh, right, absolutely. I just want to say that also the methods are different, that we briefly touched on this previously, that her method is considerably more phenomenological than that of her colleagues,
mm-hmm.
who are much more mechanical and mm-hmm. instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
You were saying?
No, I just was going to say that it's actually very telling, you know, that the whole thing that you said about shouting at people, it shows that we are operating here in a different context, because I think I cannot think of an industry today in which that would be admissible. Of course, it might happen in situation of stress, but still, I think for employee law, the person can still press charges if, you know, an abusive leader, if someone is shouting at them and so on and so forth. So I think she was right in an age in which that was more common. So the whole idea of being constructive and orienting people was very revolutionary almost.
Right. Yeah. And that made me think of Ford's compliance ensuring methods. That, remember, Henry Ford had this department that would ensure that employees remain morally correct. We'll mm-hmm. probably get to reading something from Ford, but that would involve basically going to their houses and forcing them, confiscating stuff and
mm-hmm.
basically ensuring this good man thing that way.
Yes.
Well, I mean, we have established that Follett is considerably more humanistic, probably owing in large part to her emphasis on psychology rather than
mm-hmm.
time motion studies and this kind of more external understanding of what humans can do and why they do that.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting when we read the Elton Mayo and the whole human relations people.
Yeah. Yes.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think we covered most of it. What did you take away from it primarily, Pedro?
Well, first of all, I really liked reading something that had a different structure because it was more a reflective piece because it was based on a lecture. And as for the content, I think it was interesting to read a bit of a pioneer of a different stream of, I would say, a different way of conceiving of management on an organization, one that has gone to go, I don't know, from human relations to socio-technical systems and the type of stock, something that acknowledges the power of the context, that employees work around other people, you know, and that you have to understand the context in which work is inserted. As a sociologist, of course, it's down my alley, you know, to understand the context and not only assume that people respond to stimulus directly. So that's, for me, the main take-home lesson.
I really enjoyed the reflective part of it. I suppose her explicit emphasis on the importance of philosophizing over why we do certain things and not others, and why some of them may be more valid than others. I value that greatly.
Yeah. Mm.
And it's just interesting to, the first sentence still says everything for me. When she talks about being responsible and conscious, being mindful of how we go about, or the managers of
mm-hmm.
early 20th century go about their work, is fundamental, because so much, even in my own work, sometimes it so often creeps mm-hmm. into this autopilot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You go through emails and you just answer them and you don't necessarily reflect on what or how you're doing sometimes. It's an ongoing work, both okay. personally and in the relation to people who this work is being carried out with. So I found that very refreshing.
I think I appreciated definitely the general sense of humbleness, the approach towards the listeners, or in this case, the readers. I took away definitely this idea of listening more to the employees, considering them as a source of knowledge, but also as people who should contribute and who can give a valuable contribution. And generally, this deconstruction or this demolishing of my concept of what giving orders means.
What I really took away was her idea that integration is the basic law of life, and that orders, to build on what Miranda said, because I see that the same way, that there's this range of things you can give orders about, but in the things that matter, the orders are this composite of the different perspectives. People who are giving orders and the people who are receiving them, which then you say, well, then it's not, you're not really giving and receiving, it's sort of a collective understanding of the situation. Because I think that very much relates to knowledge work and the nature of work today. And yet she's writing in the 1800s and 1900s, but she's got this perspective that's very applicable to work today. So that's what I took away.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot. And thank you for listening.
Yay.
Thank you, everyone.
Has been yes. fun, and I must say I have missed podcasting over the Christmas break. This concludes episode 5. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please get in touch with us via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website and give us some feedback. We would also greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a positive review on iTunes. Even a brief one helps new listeners find us there. You may have noticed that we had some audio quality issues this time. This is because of some hardware problems during the recording that we are working hard to resolve. Next time, we are going to be discussing Max Weber's Economy and Society, Chapter 11 on Bureaucracy. To learn more about these and future episodes, get copies of the text, and for our blog, please visit www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now, you may recall that in our Christmas message, we mentioned that we are developing two new segments for the podcast. One of these, Summaries, is going to be released next week and will consist of a summary of this episode. The purpose of Summaries is, on the one hand, to provide our time-strapped listeners with a way to participate in talking about organizations, and, on the other, to provide potential new listeners with a taster of the full episodes. Also, you will notice that we will discontinue making pre-episode supplements, unless there is a specialist guest involved, as was the case on episode 4 with Katharina Dietrich, whose supplement received amazing feedback from the author of the books we discussed himself. Anyway, be on the lookout for our newest member Johan and his summary of episode 5 next week, and get in touch with us with any questions and suggestions. We look forward to seeing you next time, as we discuss Bureaucracy by Max Weber, here on Talking About Organizations.